Iran's defense minister dismisses the recent Israeli threats, saying that Tehran will give a crushing response to any unwise move. A 100 Palestinian prisoners go on a hunger strike to protest what's been described as Israel's oppressive detention conditions. At least 8 people are confirmed dead and several more injured in a shooting incident on a Russian university campus. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Ehud Zahavi. Good to have you with us. Now, Iran's defense minister has played down the recent Israeli threats against his country. He says that the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any unwise move. Brigadier General Mohammad Rezashtiani says that Israel's recent allegations against Iran are out of desperation. He warned that Tel Aviv will pay dearly for any act of aggression. Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid recently accused Iran of marching toward a nuclear weapon. Lapid also threatened that the regime will act if the world fails to stop Iran from obtaining nuclear capabilities. Iran has time and again said its nuclear program is non-military and solely for civilian purposes, including power generation. A new report has emerged on the 2020 assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The report highlights the U.S. collusion at the most senior levels in the killing that was carried out by the Israeli spy agency Mossad. The details in this next report.
A U.S. daily has revealed new details about the last year assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Israel was already long believed to have been behind the murder that took place on November 27, 2020. Immediately after the killing, an informed source told Press TV that the remains of the weapon used in the assassination showed that it had been made in Israel. But a recent New York Times article publicizes fresh information, including the fact that Fakhrizadeh was at the top of Israel's hit list since 2007. That entailed an assassination plot in 2009, which was called off at the last moment as Israel's spy agency Mossad feared its scheme had been compromised. The article by the American Daily also confirmed earlier declarations by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC had said a satellite-controlled machine gun with artificial intelligence was used to take out the scientist. Perhaps most significantly, though, the report sheds light on the extensive collusion of the U.S. in the assassination. It says preparation for the operation began after a series of meetings in late 2019 and early 2020 between Israeli officials and high-ranking American authorities. Those meetings were led by the then Mossad director, Yossi Cohen, and former U.S. President Donald Trump, his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and the then CIA director, Gina Haspel. Fakhrizadeh's killing was the latest desperate effort in the joint Israeli-U.S. venture to derail Iran's nuclear program, a campaign that has included several other assassinations, acts of sabotage, and cyber attacks. While promising revenge and justice, Iran has refused to be cowed and remains resolute in pushing ahead with its nuclear program. However, the brazen U.S. and Israeli violation of international law and human rights should alarm the international community, whose apathy and muted response may come back to haunt it.
In other news, 100 Palestinian prisoners have gone on a hunger strike to protest Israel's rising pressure and punitive measures. The Palestinian Prison Society says that inmates in Ofer Prison, near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, have launched a strike. The measure comes in response to oppressive detention conditions that followed the jailbreak of prisoners from another Israeli prison earlier this month. 6 prisoners escaped Gilboa prison on September the 6th. They were later captured by the regime security forces. Since then, Israel has toughened restrictions on Palestinian prisoners. and their families. Monarch Kendil says that authorities at Ofer Prison have failed to commit to their promises of removing oppressive and punitive measures against Palestinian prisoners.
Following the jailbreak and after six Palestinian prisoners fled the Jilboa prison earlier this month, and now the Israeli authorities and prison administration tried to punish the other prisoners, tried to punish thousands of Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in Israeli jails. That's why prisoners at the first, they decided to be engaged in an open-ended hunger strike, including some 1,400 Palestinian prisoners from the different political powers affiliated with the different political powers in all the Israeli jails. However, the Israeli prison administration then said they will stop all these illegal practices against them and the punishments against them. But it seems, mainly in the jail of Ofer, nothing has changed. Prisoners are still being oppressed and attacked by the Israeli jailers. That's why today 100 Palestinian prisoners affiliated with the different political factions decided to start an open-ended hunger strike.
Now, Palestinian officials say that Israel has made mass arrests in the occupied territories in response to a high-security prison break earlier this month. We've discussed that issue with our guests in our news review program.
Sign up for News Review segments where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Palestinian officials say Israel has carried out mass arrests in the occupied territories in response to a high-security prison break earlier this month. More than 100 Palestinians have been arrested. That's according to the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the Palestinian Prisoners Organization. They said they had documented an average of 14 arrests a day since the jailbreak on September 6, children and students are among the detainees. As part of its crackdown after the jailbreak, Israel also raided several Palestinian organizations in the West Bank. The regime launched the crackdown to recapture six Palestinian prisoners who had escaped from a high-security Israeli jail. Joining us on this edition of the News Review program is Paul Larudi from the Free Palestine Movement, and we also have John Elmer, a journalist and researcher. Gentlemen, welcome. And Paul, if I can start with you, do you sense that Israel is perhaps taking its anger out on the Palestinians with this arrest campaign? Because it failed. There was a prison break and there was a security breach.
I wouldn't do too much to emotional reactions in Israel. They Israel will use every development to as an excuse to further its goals of ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinians, to rid Palestine of Palestinians. And that's what this is about. I mean, they can use this as a pretext to disrupt the lives and arrest large numbers of Palestinians that eventually they probably would arrest, or who knows, if they pursue them, they might find reasons to harm them. So this is just a pretext. They don't really believe that coming down harder on the Palestinians is going to reduce the resistance. If they're honest, they will notice that the Palestinians are likely to increase their resistance the more oppression Israel applies to them.
Right. John, what's your views on this the collective punishment by the Israel? At the end of the day, it was just six Palestinians who dug out of an Israeli prison?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lack of human intelligence, so there was signals intelligence that they used, but they arrested family members, which is something that they usually do, harass people. I actually think that Israel was quite careful with this. They were really unsure how the prisoners inside the prisons were going to respond. There was talk of a hunger strike. There was riots inside the prisons. I think Israel was concerned about what had happened in the Gaza Strip in May, where there was really no resolution to the mini war that happened. And that war was justified by Hamas as standing up for Palestinians in the West Bank as an attempt to unify the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So I think with these prisoners, Israel was actually took it quite carefully, I think, compared to how they could have done it, worried about the resistance, worried about inflaming the reaction. The Palestinian prisoners in Palestinian society have overwhelming support. To push back against the prisoners is something that Israel really doesn't see in its interest, and especially in this case where the whole world was watching.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly did see some remarkable resistance in Jenin during that intifada. Quite unexpected. Paul, would you agree that Jenin, that was some resistance the soldiers, the men, the Palestinians put up?
That's correct. It was the strongest point of resistance there, and Nablus were both strong resistance points in 2002 against the occupation. But Jenin paid the price because a good portion of the camp was leveled to the ground, and nevertheless the resistance has continued ever since that time. To say that the Israelis exercise restraint, I'm reminded of a Zionist at a university here in the States where I was speaking many years ago, and he made the claim that the Israelis were being had shown restraint in Gaza by only killing 1,000 Palestinians there, and I said, how do you call that restraint? And he said, well, we have the opportunity to kill all of them. Restraint is a strange way to characterize what Israel has done by exercising massive collective punishment and arrest of Palestinians. Certainly, the Palestinians that I've spoken to did not consider it to be restraint. They considered it to be an onerous way of trying to crush the Palestinians.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests for their time and their contribution. Paul Larudi there from the Free Palestine Movement joining us out of Berkeley, and John Elmer, journalist and researcher, joining us out of Toronto. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review program.
Welcome back. Let's move on. At least 8 people have been confirmed dead and 6 others are said to be injured in a shooting incident on a Russian university campus. It happened at Perm State University, close to the Ural Mountains. Terrified people were filmed escaping from a building through windows. The campus social media alerted everyone to leave if possible or lock themselves inside rooms. The reason for the shooting remains unknown. Officials have encoded saying that a perpetrator has been apprehended. In Russia, partial results from parliamentary elections show the ruling United Russia Party winning the majority of the votes. Nearly 75% of the ballots have been counted. United Russia is ahead with almost half of the ballots. Rival, the Communist Party, has only managed to secure around 20%, and this is a sign of a weaker performance for the ruling party, which won over 54% of the votes in the last parliamentary polls. Kremlin accused authorities of large-scale vote rigging, claiming that the election was a sham. Our Moscow correspondent Marina Kortyanova joined us a short while ago with more information on the Russian parliamentary elections.
A total of 18 political parties participated in the elections to the 8th Russian State Duma, the lower house of parliament, and in addition to the State Duma elections, voters also cast their ballots for the heads of 9 Russian regions and members of 39 regional parliaments. So this morning I read the analytics, and this is what experts say about the elections. So the 8th State Duma became more left-wing, although the classical division into left and right has long been outdated. Parties with a socialist orientation, and these include at least 4 of them, received a total of about a third of the votes. That is 1.5 times more than in the last elections. So the Communist Party is gaining more than 20%, surpassing its best result in this century. So they reached 19% in the elections 10 years ago, but fallen short of its historic record, 24% in 1999.
The thorny issue of EU-Russia relations has generated heated exchanges in the European Parliament. A proposal to award a prize to Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny has met criticism from a number of EU lawmakers. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The U.S. pullout from Afghanistan was a messy one. 20 years later, and after $3 trillion or more in spending, the U.S. has pulled out. But is that the end of the war machine? Definitely not. Hi, I'm Kamit Halfway, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at how the U.S. is gathering up its resources and energy to deal with its arch foe, China. Coming up in today's program, the U.S.-Afghan pullout, the U.S. readying for serious engagement with China, economically and even militarily. This reset, can it pull it off? Or is it too late to stop China's economic prowess? We'll have to wait and see. One of the other highlights of this program, Afghanistan, not the last U.S. pullout. Reports of U.S. pulling out of Syrian bases, Iraq, as it has stated, and maybe even Yemen. Even the U.S. said the U.S. was bogged down in West Asia for too long. Is that a retreat for the U.S.? And finally, the economic challenges for the U.S. in dealing with China, technologically and through trade. But doesn't the U.S. need China more than China needing the U.S.?
The U.S. decision to withdraw from Afghanistan marks the U.S. defeat of time and money. The Afghan war cost the U.S. taxpayers over $2 trillion in revenues, in which interest on the loan to carry out that will be paid for years to come. This pullout, however, has posed an opportunity for a new geopolitical space for China. And if the U.S. continues to withdraw from countries in the West Asia region, like Syria, Iraq, and possibly its support for Yemen, this may give China, and maybe even Russia, a chance to fill that space.
Well, most of the countries realize that the situation has changed from the time with the collapse of the Soviet Union, where you really had one superpower. That one superpower has exerted its power in a variety of ways, not least of all in Afghanistan, as a dismal failure. And most of the countries have seen that. People are not generally, they don't hate the United States, but they're very cautious in dealing with the U.S. because of this this intensive feeling among many of the political elites here in the United States that we have got to set the rules.
Countries like Russia, Iran, Pakistan, and Persian Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia will more likely welcome a more active China, especially with the expansion of the Belt and Road Initiative. So detrimental to U.S.'s so-called superpower image was the Afghan pullout that East Asian countries like Japan and South Korea may also think twice about siding with the U.S. in countering China.
I mean, even countries like in Europe, even our so-called allies, really frown on the fact that the United States should not be the rule setter, that other countries have to have a say because they have a general interest. And in particular, most of the countries realize that China, which they don't always understand so well, really also wants to have a say in what direction the world goes in. And from what we can see of their own development, there's a lot of positive things they're doing. The Belt and Road Initiative, this has brought development to a world where development had been lacking for the last two or three decades.
There are obviously think tanks in the U.S. who believe that the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan was indeed necessary, not only because it was due time, but also because the threat that the U.S. sees from China, whether perceived or not, requires a lot of resources and money. Now, these are the main points of their argument. First, it could liberate military resources for the U.S. currently that was tied down in Afghanistan, allowing them to be redeployed to the Indo-Pacific theater, as it's called. And then it could also free up the diplomatic and bureaucratic bandwidth of U.S. senior officials. And finally, it could save the U.S. government money, unlocking billions of dollars that could be better devoted to fund initiatives that would boost America's standing in its competition with China. Well, our guest joining us for this edition of the program is Zhao He. He is a research fellow at the Institute of World Economics and Politics at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Or sciences. Okay, Zhao, welcome. Do you see a relation between the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan and the way that the U.S. wants to deal with China in the economic and technological sphere in respect where the U.S. is trying to allocate and channel its resources to confront China and to not continue spending it in places like Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think these two things are very much connected. And as we all know, since 2017, American national security strategy has changed. And since then, the U.S. has been trying to focus on China and reallocate its strategic assets towards the so-called Indo-Pacific area, and particularly focus on China. So under that overall strategy, continue to pour resources into Afghanistan is very problematic and strategically not worth it. So I think that's why, since the Trump administration, the U.S. has determined to pull out of Afghanistan, and actually President Biden just finished the job. And so far you can see that I think continuously the U.S. will move its assets, military intelligence and other assets towards the Asia Pacific, and particularly focus on China, as I said. And the U.S. will use more other method, including export controls, sanctions, and other non-military methods against China, instead of trying to continue to use its superior military capability around the world.
Time now for a new section where we will look at stories that may become topics for our next program. Now, for our first story, we're going to take a look at China and its rejection of big tech. This article stated that China's rejection of big tech monopoly capitalism is the focus for China, and it doesn't want to basically see China going the route that the U.S. has done. First of all, how is it going to be able to do that? Well, it's going to refuse allowing its homegrown technology companies to be dominant in the way that Amazon and Google are in the West. We can mention Alibaba, for example. And basically, it wants to put its focus on manufacturing, to make a long story short. Next up, BRICS Summit. It had one, and the BRICS nations composed of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It's an important meeting. Have met the host country, even though it was a virtual meeting, but I should say the host was the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And he focused on three things which were the theme of the summit, the three C's: cooperation, for continuity, and consolidation. Now, BRICS is still relevant because it does have investments for its member countries into different sectors. Next up, U.S. national debt, obviously a big factor for the U.S., and it's on track to default, as of the recording of this program, on its national debt for the month of October. We have to wait and see if that happens. By the time this program gets aired, maybe it's going to be solved. But it's an ongoing problem. Basically, the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, said that if this happens and the debt limit is not raised, it will be the first time in U.S. history. This is basically has come out to be a bipartisan theatrical politics, so to speak, because at the end it always gets solved. Finally, breaking U.S. sanctions. Yes, Iran has done it again, delivering its first fuel shipment to Lebanon. That is a big deal because it shows that the U.S. sanctions did not work. Iran is invincible towards it. In this particular case, Lebanon needs the fuel badly. The way it did it, it entered Syria to transfer to Lebanon and did that via tankers.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Here we are going to devote what the U.S. may lose by focusing on China after pulling out of Afghanistan. First, the U.S. needs China more than China needs the U.S. economically speaking. For example, the U.S. depends heavily on China for providing low-cost goods. Now, this is especially applicable when it comes to income-constrained American consumers. Now, these are American consumers who are having a hard time making ends meet. Now, moving on to the other area where the U.S. depends on China, it has to deal with exports. China is America's third largest export market, next to Mexico and Canada. That obviously is something that should concern the U.S. Now, the U.S. also depends on China to provide funding for its budget deficit. You can see over here, $1.3 trillion is how much debt or foreign holder of U.S. Treasury securities China has in direct ownership. Imagine a lack of Chinese buying. That could turn the next Treasury auction into a rout. And finally, this is a bit of truth that is the outcome of the structure of the U.S. economy's weakness when it comes to Americans' spending habits. America depends on China because Americans don't have enough savings. For example, in the fourth quarter of 2017, the net domestic saving rate was just 1.3% of the national income. Now, how will it be able to increase Americans' savings? Well, in order to consume and grow, the U.S. must import surplus foreign savings from abroad. That is the naked truth. And run massive balance of payments and trade deficits to import this capital. But how can it do that when the U.S. had trade deficits with 102 nations? That's right, 102 nations. Okay, let's bring in William Jones for a breakdown. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review and a non-resident fellow of Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies. Bill Jones, welcome. Why did the U.S. fall behind China, estimated to take over the U.S. as the number one economy by the year 2028? I mean, is it because of the U.S. spending monies on wars, for example, across the globe and its military bases, instead of focusing on things like infrastructure or education and scientific development in areas like 5G?
Well, obviously, the situation of Afghanistan has created a situation where the United States, which is pulled out, doesn't really have much influence on the development in Afghanistan. They have no representations on site. They're withholding money to the Taliban and waiting and see what happens. China, on the other hand, has really taken a forward position here. They do have a relationship with the Taliban. They are willing to help. The Taliban, in its turn, has said that they really would want to work with China. So, but the U.S. is still concerned with what happens in Afghanistan because it doesn't want it to become a center of terrorism and have the same problems they had 20 years ago with the 9/11 situation. Will the United States stop their freedom of navigation forays into the China Sea? Will they stop trying to impose a technological apartheid on China through trade tariffs? And I don't think that's going to happen. But there has to be some give in this situation on the part of the U.S. in order to maintain stability in the relationship.
The story of the U.S. losing its status as a so-called superpower is being highlighted these days, especially after its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan. Marred by COVID-19, its economy has not fully recovered from the pandemic.
There's still clearly a huge amount of open positions. There's still clearly a shortage in some industries. There's still clearly a problem with some industries that require more certifications and things like that that are time dependent.
In the meantime, under these harsh circumstances for the U.S., it is insisting on confronting China. China, in the meantime, has achieved success in its fight against poverty. It has put forth the grand vision under the leadership of its president, Xi Jinping, to vitalize its rural areas in its fight against poverty.
President Xi Jinping rightly celebrates the success of China's targeted poverty alleviation campaign, which by the end of last year, 2020, had brought about 100 million of the intractably poor out of extreme poverty. For China to achieve the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation, eliminating extreme poverty was necessary. But it was not sufficient. China must continue to fight poverty by reducing still substantial relative poverty and close the still excessive wealth gap, primarily between rural and urban areas. Enhancing rural standards of living exemplifies China's long-range vision to the years 2035 and 2050, when China's goal is to become a fully modernized socialist nation. And President Xi allows no delay in making the historic transition from poverty alleviation to rural vitalization. Without the vitalization of the countryside, there can be no social stability, no common prosperity, no national rejuvenation. But while grand visions are formulated by central leadership, they must be implemented by local grassroots officials.
It has also issued a white paper to elaborate on its prosperity. The white paper said that China had completed the historic transformation from poverty to securing access to food and clothing, to a decent life, and finally, to moderate prosperity. This against the unsuccessful backdrop of U.S. efforts.
They've also gone for poverty, the first country, biggest country in the world, which has effectively eliminated extreme poverty. We haven't even done that in the United States. And those are things that I think should be markers for most countries and for humanity at large. And most of the countries in the world realize that this is a positive element here, and they want to work together with it. So I don't think they're going to simply follow the bugle call of the United States to go to a conflict.
But the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has one main purpose, to secure its resources and to channel it against China. And it is not just Afghanistan that the U.S. has withdrawn its forces from. drawdowns have been reported in Iraq and in Syria, with Yemen to maybe in the works. The West Asia region is no longer of U.S. interest, and the reason may be purely for profits. Brown University's Costs of War Project released a report that revealed that the Pentagon spending totaled over $14 trillion since the start of the war in Afghanistan, with one-third to one-half of the total going to military contractors. A large portion of these contracts, one-quarter to one-third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years, have gone to just five major corporations: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget, as the report reads.
Well, I think the U.S. Current relative decline has multiple sources. One, of course, is that after 9/11, the U.S. has very much invested in the so-called war on terror, and invests so much that its domestic need has not been met. So over the years, we've seen numbers like very high numbers that the U.S. has invested in its war capabilities, and is deploying military around the world, particularly in the Middle East and in Central Asia. So that's really a waste of money. However, a small group of Americans really benefited from this, and a U.S. Stock market, the capital market, also benefit from this. During this time, as you said, there are many domestic problems should be taken care of, but not being taken care of because of political divide within the United States. So, and you know, political difficulties blocking that solution. So as we've seen over the past two decades, the infrastructure is lagging behind, and also there's a serious problem of social and economic gap between the rich and the poor. So moving forward, I think the number one priority for the U.S. should be taking care of its domestic problem instead of intervening into other countries' internal affairs.
Southeast Asia will take a major economic hit if shipping is either disrupted or, worse yet, blocked in the South China Sea. Now, that's one of the points of conflict between the U.S. and China in what is known as the South China Sea conflict, and in particular, how that serves as a trade route. Now, the U.S. wants to take the revenues produced in that region. That's somewhat of an assumption, but it seems like that is the U.S.'s goal, to take those revenues away from China or decrease it by a substantial amount. Well, to get the final comments from our guest, Zhai Hai, who's a research fellow at the Institute of World Economics, and also Bill Jones, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review, both rejoining us for this final segment. Zhai, I'm going to start with you and our final question. The U.S. superpower status downgraded by many across the world, many analysts, be it militarily or in the economic sphere, but the U.S. is still pursuing China. On a military level, does the U.S. alienation mean that it will not have the support of countries, not only in the Asia region, but also in Europe and elsewhere in the respect where they're not going to be on board with it to confront China?
Well, I think, first of all, the U.S. continue to be the world's most powerful country. That's for sure. Even though with current relative decline, the U.S. still maintain a superior military power comparing to all the rest of the world combined, pretty much. So I think in that respect, U.S. continue to lead in its military realm. However, the world is now diversifying, and there are multipolar other powers arising, and this world order is changing from the post-Cold War unipolar into a multipolar world. Many other countries, including Europe and China and other developing countries groupings, are having a staying in international affairs. So U.S. has no monopoly on many other issues. Many other countries can contribute in the area of like the pandemic or climate change or urgent issues that humanities are facing currently.
All right, well, Bill, the U.S. superpower status downgraded by many, as was mentioned here, whether it's militarily or in the economic sphere, and it has fallen behind China. which is set to overtake the U.S. Economically by the year 2028 for it to be the number one economy. Is it because of the U.S. spending expenditures on wars across the globe that this has happened to the U.S.? We could mention military bases and military spending overall.
Well, yes, that latter is both are the case. The fact that they have spent a lot of money in military wars, which have leaded really nowhere except to further devastation. Afghanistan is a prime example of that. You can also look in the Middle East and see the same type of situation. But also there's been an utter neglect of investment in science and technology. And what the Chinese have done, with a population of 1.4 billion people, by the way, is they have followed much the example that the United States was following in the 1960s. We have to continue, you know, exerting ourselves. The almighty dollar will buy whatever we need, and therefore we don't have to do a lot of investment in science and technology, so that they became, in many respects, backwards, and the Chinese have moved forward. U.S. still remains a major scientific power, and I'm sure
the so-called superpower status of the U.S. is in jeopardy, and the U.S. is declining in its might, both in its economy and also its military. Yes, even the military, because the U.S. can't win a conflict by air, and its ground forces, well, they couldn't even defeat the Taliban when they had 100,000 forces combined with NATO forces in that country. And now they want to take on China in the business and military arena. So desperate that the U.S. had to send its VP Harris recently to Asia to rally support around her during her recent visit of the regional countries, that is. And as far as U.S. war adventurism is concerned, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, need I say more? No wins there. So obviously, remains to be seen how the U.S. is going to be able to even penetrate China's sphere economically and militarily. That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Romy Kovatahwe and the entire team, this is goodbye until next time.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. In the previous episode, we started talking about financial corruption and how it affects the rights of people. And we said there are main types of financial corruption, and we spoke about one. And I'd like to speak about a few more as well, just so the picture becomes more clearer. Amongst the types of corruptions when it comes to financial corruption is, in fact, bribery. And bribery is a type of corruption where a person or an organization pays an amount of money to another person or organization to take a right that's not his, or to, you know, get away from something that he should do. To make this more clear, to give you an example, if you want to get, let's say, for argument's sake, if you want to get a passport or you want to get a driver's license or something of that sort, and then you know, for example, you don't have the requirements to get such a thing, what you end up doing is paying a worker, an administrative worker, you pay him off, and then he get it for you. And I've seen this with my own eyes, per se. And then you get it done. So you basically took a right that is not yours. You shouldn't be doing this. On the other hand, you have people, for example, who have to perform a certain duty to the community or to the country. For example, a person has to go to, you know, to the army. In many countries, it's compulsory to go to the army. So what they end up doing is they end up paying. Like, you know what, I'll give you this amount of money and exclude me from the army, for example. And this is just an example to make it, you know, easy to understand what bribery is. So if I pay to get something done or to, you know, relieve myself of something that I should have been doing, then this is a type of what? Corruption. And when we talk about bribery, it always happens the fact that there are two people involved. So there's the person who pays the bribery, and there's a person who receives the bribery. And sometimes, and this happens a lot, you have a third person involved. You have the middleman involved. So sometimes I don't have connection with the person in this department. So what I end up doing, I go to a person who knows that person. So I pay to that person for his services, and I pay the bribe to that officer through that middleman. So sometimes it takes one person, sometimes it takes two people, or sometimes it could be more, depending on how desperate you are to get what you want to get. And this kind of bribery, sometimes it's very easy to catch and very easy to put the finger on in countries where they have a monitoring system, where the government, for example, or the department monitors their workers, and they monitor the work, and they monitor everything else, what goes in, what goes outside, what's being done, what's not being done. Sometimes it's easy to find those people and catch them. But in countries where it is pretty much chaotic and lawless, or the law itself, you know, it could be bent and mended depending on the person sitting behind the chair, then these kind of things will obviously go unnoticed. And it becomes, not just unnoticed, becomes a problem. That it becomes a very known problem that this department, for example, will not do this thing for you, or this contract, for example, unless you pay. And everyone is okay with it. They're, obviously, the law is not asking anyone, they're not making it a crime, so everyone gets away with it. Now, stay with us, and we come back after a short break.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. So as we said, when we talk about bribery, sometimes you have people who work in the government themselves. They take bribes and they accept bribes from people. For example, if a police officer pulls you over for speeding, and you live in a country where, you know, it's things like this happens, and then you pay him off and you go. That creates a sense of lawlessness. And not only that, but it makes you feel that you're above the law. Not just that, it makes you feel that I could speed at any time I want. And God forbid, one of these times that you're speeding, you could end up killing someone and taking their right away, or taking their life away to begin with. So if we have this kind of corruption happening, then we should be expecting, or we should expect all sorts of corruption to happen. And especially when the society that we live in find it to become the norm, something very normal to indulge in. And I've seen this in some of the countries that I went to. They said to me, well, if you want to get it done quicker, just pay. I said, no, I'm not paying anyone. He's supposed to be doing his job. And they say to me, in this case, good luck getting it done. Because the people themselves, the administrators, the workers themselves, they say, well, you want to get this done, right? Sure. You're not willing to pay for it? Sure. Well, we will delay you. We will make it almost impossible for you to get it. Even if your paperwork is up to date, even if your paperwork is all done and all correct and you have all the required documents, they say we won't do it, you know? Come back tomorrow, come back next week. And they just don't do it. You get forced to pay someone, to pay a bribe in order to get your application, for example, done or whatever you're seeking, getting it approved, by forcing you to do what? To pay a bribery. So, and this is a problem for so many societies, be it civilized societies or be it non-civilized societies. I mean, non-civilized in the sense of their political system is corrupted. When it comes to the law enforcement is corrupted, then really there is no much civilization happening there, is it? When you cannot get anything done unless you have to pay with your all your savings, then that's a problem, that this is not civilization. So we have to keep that in mind. Now, sometimes me and you as a human beings, we also feel the need to get things done quicker, get things done to our advantage, and we say, you know what, I'm not doing anything wrong, I'm just paying someone to do it quicker for me. Yeah, well, that's the thing. This is what bribery is. Paying to get something done that you shouldn't have paid. You should have just wait like anyone else, wait in line, and wait for your turn. But when you try to speed up the process or get something or gain something quick through paying someone off, then this is a bribery. And bribery in Islam is haram. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam in a hadith, he cursed the one who does bribery, the one who accepts bribery, and the one who receives bribery, and the one who sees it and does nothing about it. These people are cursed by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. So not only the fact that it's caused corruption in the society, it's actually a haram act that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the day of judgment will punish those who indulge themselves or those who practice the act of bribery. For whatever reason that you might think of, it's still haram. You cannot justify it for yourself or you cannot justify it for anyone else. We'll leave it up to here and then we continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.